6:37 on the Drive with Duff. Just enough time to talk to the last angry man about the next hour. Beryl Wiseman joins us now. Hey.
Hey. Well, the next hour we're going to be attacking the kind of wrong-headed, idiotic thinking that you just went through with Rita. I can't even believe your patience. But, you know, we've got it's like the world turned upside down. That song that General Cornwallis had his band play when the Americans won the Revolution. We're going to be discussing the poor Chinese who are now upset at Canada for Canada actually talking about human rights.
Screw them.
We're going to be talking about the wonderful United Nations Human Rights Council, who has called yet another special session to denounce Israel again.
Again?
And they denounced Israel.
Isn't this a weekly event now?
Listen to the numbers. They have denounced Israel more often and talked about Israel more often than anything else in the world since the existence of the United Nations.
Yeah, that's right. In Iran, the war to end Israel is going to break out soon, according to Ahmadinejad.
And just to complete the circle of wrong-headed thinking and bring it back home, not that the foreign policies don't affect us, we're going to be speaking with Professor Michael Geist on the privacy status of Canada. You may remember last week there was a report that was put out internationally that said that Canada was second-best nation in protecting privacy rights. Well, Michael Geist, who's a professor of privacy and internet law at the University of Ottawa, said, well, that says more about how badly the other nations do it than anything we're doing right.
I say let everybody know everything about everybody. I just put it all on the web.
Hell, I put everything I do on the web, but that's my choice. I don't want them going through my underwear.
No, I want everybody to know everything. Yeah, absolutely.
Well,
I have no
okay,
secrets.
Then I think that you are under an obligation, James Conner Duff, to start a website and put everything you've done in the last 30 years on it.
Oh, wait a second. I said recently.
No. That's recent in the context of, you know, historical.
All right, I'll write
timeline.
The book. All right, why don't I just write the book? And it'll be a bestseller.
But I got a
hey, OJ wrote a book, and he's going to make $3.5 million. He says he murdered his wife, his ex-wife and her lover.
They're making signs at us again, Jim.
Oh, yeah, okay. All right, well, have a good time. That's Beryl Wiseman.
Good. Yeah. You're using the word good
again. All right. Have a really lousy
Thank
time.
Thank you.
I hope you get no calls. All right.
I don't look for calls. You're trying to elevate them, but if they want to call in and be elevated, let them call.
All right. Beryl Wiseman, Last Angry Man. Thanks to Sabrina Marandola, Melissa Wheeler, Chris Bunbury for putting the show together. Thank you for listening. Back tomorrow.
As I said at the beginning of last night's show, we tried to start this week on a positive note, highlighting positive achievement by Canadians on the world stage. And yesterday, things got screwy in the world again. We had that wonderful report called the Alliance for Civilization, sponsored by the United Nations, co-chaired by people like Desmond Tutu, a Nobel Prize winner, together with Mohammed Khatami, the former Iranian president who ordered the execution of Montreal photojournalist Zahra Kazemi, a report which said that the problem with Islamofascism is really not political, is really not religious, I'm sorry, but it's really political and is really based on the Arab-Israeli issue. So we should not pay too much attention to the Ahmadinejads of the world and just settle that issue and everything will be hunky-dory and we should all get along. So we took on that piece of madness last night, but the hits just kept on coming today. Front page on the papers this morning, China snubs Canada. Well, China, poor China, they're upset. They canceled the meeting that they had asked for with our prime minister because Canada, for the first time, showed guts, as this prime minister has consistently showed, and refused to take human rights off the table. Well, poor, pitiful China. We're shipping jobs there, we're shipping money there, and for every dollar they spend back here, it's subsidized 50% by our Export Development Corporation. But we're going to talk about that piece of insanity that is being bemoaned in the chattering class liberal salons in certain places of central Canada later on in the hour. We're going to start with the third piece of insanity and hypocrisy this week. The so-called United Nations Human Rights Council was convened. This was a remake of the old United Nations Human Rights Commission, and they had an extraordinary emergency special session yet again, this time to condemn Israel for the accidental bombing carried out in Beit Hanun, without any mention, of course, of the 2,000 Qassam rocket attacks Israel has suffered, without any mention of the fact that Hamas and Fatah units have managed to destroy the town of Sderot in Israel. None of that mattered. This council has taken on Israel as the singular issue more than any issue in the world since the creation of the United Nations. And, of course, this highly principled resolution was supported by such sterling advocates of human rights like Algeria, Bangladesh, China, that kills 20,000 political prisoners a year, Cuba, Djibouti, Indonesia, Malaysia, whose president, you may recall, a few years ago said that the whole world's being run by an international Jewish conspiracy, and on and on and on, the usual suspects. Well, there was a voice of reason there, not for Israel, not for the Jewish state, for the free world, for Israel as the frontline nation and the family of free peoples. And I want to read a good part of this. As of today, this gentleman said, this council has now held more special sessions to denounce Israel than it has held regular sessions concerning everything else in the world. Raises an obvious question. If the special sessions denouncing Israel are more regular than the regular sessions concerning everything else in the world, perhaps these definitions ought to be reversed and the special sessions denouncing Israel become the regular sessions. Reflection upon the actions of the one completed regular session held in June suggests, however, that this may not be so simple. That regular session specially adopted only one resolution against a specific country, denouncing Israel alone out of all 192 member states. The regular session created a special permanent agenda item to denounce Israel for all future sessions. In the resolution renewing expert mandates, the regular session inserted a special footnote for the special rapporteur on Palestine, who openly admits that his instructions are to denounce Israel only. His instructions. And so, Mr. President, upon further reflection, it turns out that the only full regular session concerning everything else in the world was in practice and in effect a special session meant to denounce only Israel. This pattern will persist if democratic countries represented in this hall continue to show weakness of resolve in the face of an organized mischief that is both united and energetic, and if some continue to argue that today's subversion of the council should be celebrated as testimony of its responsiveness. La capacité d'intervenir promptement en cas d'urgence. If all this continues, Mr. President, it will have turned out that under our new definition, the regular sessions are in fact regular sessions after all. But today's resolution is entirely one-sided, ignoring systematic Palestinian firing of Qassam rockets from Gaza into Israel, which just this morning killed yet another Israeli resident of Sderot as she was crossing the street with her husband. Another victim lost both his legs in the barrage. The countries who care to save this council will vote no. Anything else will be interpreted as acquiescence to the destruction of this new body. The man who said these brave words will be joining us right after this. Hillel Neuer, Executive Director of UN Watch from Geneva. We'll be right back. The man who delivered those brave words I read out at the beginning of the show joins us now, Hillel Neuer from Geneva, Executive Director of UN Watch. Hillel, welcome again. Thanks for staying up so late.
Thank you, Beryl. It's a pleasure to be on your show.
Hillel, you spoke truth to power. It's not the first time, but in the face of resolutions dripping with words, as Reverend Martin Luther King used to say, with nullification and interposition, does it ever get satisfying?
Well, on days like today, it's nothing but depressing. You know, I'm just coming from the barricades, and as you've been describing, it's truly a sad day.
Now you know why we call our magazine Barricades.
Well, there you go. It's a sad day for Western civilization, for democracy, and for any conception that we have of human rights. We're under assault, and as Winston Churchill once said, and it's what I've been feeling today, we're seeing the malice of the wicked reinforced by the weakness of the virtuous. And I got to tell you, Switzerland, and it's a country I live in, and I appreciate my host country, and I respect it. But the Swiss, their second sentence in their speech, and it was you quoted it. We talked about la capacité d'intervenir promptement en cas d'urgence. The Swiss celebrated the cynical subversion that happened today. The third special session for the third time, only dealing with Israel. Nothing else on any other issue or country or violation in the entire world, including Darfur.
And, of course, they abstained in the vote.
They abstained in the vote, as you say. And rather than call it for what it was, which indeed even the media in Switzerland now recognizes it, and this is a cynical subversion which is killing the new council in its early days, rather than recognize what it was, the Swiss, who see themselves as co-sponsors of this council, celebrated today's action as an example
of what it could do.
Human rights in action.
the words here, words matter. Words are like bullets. I want to remind our listeners, this is the same Human Rights Council that allowed Saeed Mortazavi to be sent as an observer by Iran when Prime Minister Harper called for his arrest there. Mortazavi was the prosecutor of Zahra Kazemi, the Montreal photojournalist who was killed in Iran, and Mortazavi allegedly beat her skull open with his shoe. Now listen to the wording. The Human Rights Council, affirming the applicability of the Fourth Geneva Convention relative to the protection of civilian persons in time of war. Well, they apply it in this resolution to the Palestinian territory. It has never been applied to any of the 9,000 attacks, state-sponsored attacks, against Israelis. The resolution said gravely concerned at the continued violation by Israel of the human rights of the Palestinian people. They've never been gravely concerned at the countless attacks, kidnappings, maimings of the citizens of the only democracy from the borders of Pakistan to the Moroccan Atlantic coast. Recognizing that the Israeli military incursions into Palestinian territory constitute a collective punishment of the civilians, yet never has the United Nations said a word about the complicity of governments, including Lebanon, to terror groups like Hezbollah, acknowledged terror groups, terror groups recognized as such by our government, Western governments, launching raid after raid and missile after missile, killing and displacing hundreds and thousands of Israeli citizens. How do civilized people, Hillel, even be in an organization led by a man like Kofi Annan, who covered up oil for food to protect his son, who willfully didn't allow UN peacekeepers to protect the hundreds of thousands killed in Rwanda? Is there any shame on any of these faces?
It is truly amazing to see how people manage to save face. You know, I spoke today, and sitting on the dais was the chairman of the council, who's a very polished diplomat, the ambassador from Mexico. And, of course, you read my speech, and basically
yes.
I described in the 3 minutes, because that's how much time we NGOs get. It's actually the same amount of time as observer states like the U.S. and Australia get. In 3 minutes, I tried to describe the lunacy of this charade, of this circus, and here is someone who is an aspiring diplomat on the international stage, sitting with majesty on this dais, and presuming to preside over something that is majestic, when in fact it's a circus, to put it at best. One wonders, and I saw Madame Arbour, and you know, I have respect for her as a former Supreme Court justice, and I guess as a Montrealer, I'm proud that she's there. I wish she'd be more vigorous in speaking out for things that are right and speaking truth to power, as you say. And she's going to the region next week.
Yeah, she was very vigorous in denouncing Israel, but not denouncing anybody else during the recent war.
She was this summer, and we certainly spoke out against that. She has a mixed record, and we're still hopeful that she might adopt a more balanced approach. She's going to Israel and the territories next week, and so the jury
is
out
on
that.
It's not her first trip. She's been to Israel.
I don't know that she was there as a high commissioner. Maybe
no, she wasn't there as a high commissioner, but she was there before, and that's why I wrote an article called A Lesson in Law for Louise. She knows exactly what audience she's playing to.
Yeah, well, you know, as you say, it's not clear how so many UN officials or the diplomats who preside over these bodies manage to hold themselves out as if they're presiding over something that's authoritative, that's objective, that's actually credible. And the least one could hope is that they would do their maximum. And you know, we call upon Madame Arbour to speak out. She spoke today for about 30 seconds. She told the assembled 150 ambassadors and NGOs and others that she'd be going to the region. But she didn't say, as Kofi Annan, to his credit, and I accept many of the critiques, certainly we've been very critical and outspoken on his shortcomings, but to his credit, a couple of times he has spoken out in June and September and said the council must not continue to focus on Israel alone, must look at other things. And I haven't heard her voice on that issue. And here she is. Here was the time. And here is the council going down the drain. It's the fourth resolution the council has passed, and it's 4 out of 4 against Israel alone. There's nothing on Darfur. You read the New York Times today, and it talks about hundreds who are killed by Sudanese Arab marauders in Chad. And, of course, the genocide in Darfur goes on. 200,000 plus have been killed, 1 million more displaced. Not a single word of it has been mentioned ever at the Human Rights Council.
I think
no
it,
resolution, no special session.
I think it becomes clear as who controls not only the council, but a lot of the agenda in the United Nations. Hillel, please stay with us for a short break. I want to bring this conversation back to Canada and some things that were said here today. We'll be right back with Hillel Noyer, Executive Director of UN Watch in Geneva. And our special guest is Hillel Noyer from Geneva, Switzerland, Executive Director of UN Watch, and we're talking about the degraded Human Rights Council of the United Nations yet again, condemning Israel for the bombing at Beit Hanun. This council never, ever, ever has taken on any other issues, none of the terrorist issues, none of the state-sponsored terror against the only democracy in the Middle East, nothing on Darfur. Hillel, let me ask you, Canada voted against this resolution. Now, this morning, Prime Minister Harper, in yet another new bold direction for Canadian foreign policy, told China, no, we're not taking human rights off the table. You don't want to meet with us. Don't meet with us. Was Canada's vote a reflection of a new direction in Canadian foreign policy, or would Canada normally have voted against stuff like this?
I think Canada typically did vote against stuff like this, but it depends.
Would they vote against it, or would they abstain? Because there was a lot of abstentions on garbage like this.
There were. It ranges. Typically, in the predecessor body, the Commission on Human Rights, there would typically be half the resolutions against Israel. Now, as you mentioned, it's 100%. It used to be half. You'd have about five each year.
It's good to see freedom is going up in the estimation of the Human Rights Council.
There you go. And so Canada would typically vote either no or would abstain. It would depend on the resolution. It would depend how severe it is. It would depend on the language. So sometimes it's difficult to judge. In this case, it was severe. You read out some of the outrages in this resolution. And bear in mind, as you mentioned, and as I had said in my speech, the text completely ignores any mention of Hamas terrorism. It comes on a day when a woman, Faina Slutsker, 57 years old, was slaughtered by a Qassam rocket that just landed on her, and a man lost both of his legs in the town of Sderot. So on that day, Israel was condemned for trying to defend itself against those attacks. So Canada voted no, and I'd like to think that in the past Canada would have voted no as well. But to Canada's credit, Ambassador Paul Mayer here in Geneva did two things. One is he tried to delay the resolution using a procedural device, pointing out that the council did not have time to look at the budgetary implications because they've set up a high-level fact-finding
yes,
mission.
Yes, I didn't get to that point. Yes,
those are tens of thousands of dollars,
yes,
of course, for hotels and flights and so forth for a whole entourage. And of course, they've already set up several of these this summer. There's already a fact-finding mission. There's a commission of inquiry.
I like the fact that they use words to dispatch urgently a high-level fact-finding mission. There's been no missions to find out where the hell are the Israeli soldiers kidnapped by Hezbollah and kept in Lebanon under state sponsorship. That there's no fact-finding missions about.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that.
Urgent or otherwise.
As we speak, there is a high-level commission of inquiry set up from the August special session on Lebanon, which is mandated only to look at systematic, I'm quoting now, systematic Israeli violations in Lebanon. It has no mandate.
Systematic Israeli violations of the state that sponsored the terrorist organization that launched a war against a neighboring sovereign nation.
Indeed, and as we speak, that commission of inquiry from August has tabled its report. It's under translation, and we're going to see it in a couple of days. And you can imagine what that's going to look like.
You know, you make me feel better. I wrote an op-ed that was published here called "The Lebanon is Complicit in with Hezbollah," and though it was generally well received, there was some criticism of it. You just made me feel a lot better about it. They are complicit.
Well, Lebanon is going through a difficult situation, of course, and there's a threat of a coup d'etat by Hezbollah, and it's a complicated situation. But to Canada's credit, to come back to Canada, the ambassador both raised budgetary implications and so forth, tried to delay or postpone the adoption of this one-sided resolution. And secondly, it was Canada that requested the vote. Actually, I think it was Algeria, one of the Arab countries, said, "Wait a minute, Mr. President, why are we even holding a vote? Who called the vote?" And the Canadian ambassador said, I called the vote. And you know, the U.S., he said, you know, the U.S. and Australia are not members of this council.
I was going to ask you about that, about the United States not being a member.
They're not a member. And so it falls upon Canada to take a lead on moral issues. And I have to say that we're truly thankful that we have a government that is taking stands on human rights and on principle that we haven't seen in decades.
Well, we should be truly thankful that there's Hillel Noyer out there in Geneva, a Canadian, executive director of UN Watch, who is a living embodiment of what Ralph Waldo Emerson said, one person abiding by the truth, resolute, shall rally a majority, and your words will one day. And I thank you for being with us tonight and staying up so late in Geneva.
Well, thank you. It's always my pleasure.
Take care.
Take care.
Montreal will be right back. So for the first time in many years, a Canadian prime minister has declared that our foreign policy will be set here, not in Beijing. The prime minister is en route to an APEC conference in Hanoi. And China declared today it wouldn't be meeting with him following their request for a meeting because he refused to keep human rights off the table. Now, from both a practical and a principled perspective, Prime Minister Harper has again done the right thing. The balance of trade, overwhelmingly from China to Canada. Any trade restrictions imposed by Beijing would hurt China much more than Canada. On the import side, China needs our raw materials. On the export side, China can't risk losing the preferential tariffs that she enjoys at her manufactured goods. Furthermore, for those who think that shipping Canadian jobs to China in return for their few dollars they spend here is worth anything, 50 cents of every dollar is financed by our own Export Development Corporation. But most important of all are the chattering classes in central Canada, in a lot of the media, that have actually criticized the prime minister for not agreeing to leave human rights off the agenda. Now, for many of you out there who don't know this, last year, Canada was training Chinese judges in international law, and part of that had to do with human rights law. The Chinese didn't like it, and they withdrew their judges. Joining me now to keep my blood pressure under control as we talk about the media's treatment of this story is Lauren Gunter from the National Post, one of the few storehouses of reason and sanity left in this country. Good evening, Lauren. Thanks for taking the time.
Good evening. I've never been accused of keeping people's blood pressure down.
Well, I was ready to... How does the Globe and Mail justify, you know, eight-point type China snubs Harper? It's not China snubbing Harper. Harper finally stood up again and again and again. And he's trying to move this damn country into a new direction of courage and conscience. And what is it that Toronto doesn't get?
Well, I don't know. And, I've seen all the coverage of this, and almost everyone agrees that the Chinese asked us for the meeting. And then when Harper wouldn't keep human rights off the agenda, they turned it down. So I'm wondering if they didn't suspect, the Chinese didn't suspect that Harper would do that all along. They invited him knowing he wouldn't agree to keep human rights off so that they could cancel the meeting and make this point to them. I'm hoping that the media would pick up on this and pressure Harper to take human rights off the agenda. But he's not going to do that. He's a very, very clever guy. He's not like, I saw one interview today where somebody said, well, you know, when Jean Chrétien was the prime minister, we thought that the best idea was to actively engage the Chinese in trade and then move them along through the trade to a closer understanding of Western human rights. The Chinese aren't stupid. They already understand Western human rights, and they understand they don't want them.
And they understand very well what they're doing.
And they understand that if they keep dangling this carrot of $1.3 billion market in front of the Western world, most Western leaders don't have the courage to raise their human rights record because they want their companies in that huge new consumer market.
Lauren, hold a thought for one second. I want to share a very interesting story with you about just the point you're making about liberalization. We've got to take a very, very short break. We'll be right back with Lauren Gunter of the National Post. And you can email us your comments after the show at info@iapm.ca. We're talking with the National Post, Lauren Gunter, on China canceling a meeting with Prime Minister Harper because he boldly refused to take human rights off the agenda. Lauren, you were talking about the media coverage that was focusing on the Chrétien/Martin philosophy of liberalization. Economic liberalization will lead to political liberalization. And I just wanted to share a story with you. When China Minmetals was trying to buy Inco and Falconbridge last year, and China Minmetals is a wholly owned state corporation run by the Central Committee of the Chinese Communist Party, and China openly said, we want those companies for their resources, we want to expand our military, and yeah, we're gonna send the manufacturing jobs to China. I was involved in an effort against it, and I get a call one day from I won't name the person, but he was a, financial leader of a major financial organization who was screaming at me saying, don't you understand that economic liberalization will free China just as economic liberalization freed Russia? I said, what is the matter with you? Economic liberalization didn't free Russia. Jackson Vanik, that took away most favored nation status, freed Russian dissidents. Helsinki Final Act freed Russian dissidents. And at the end of the conversation, I said, listen, let me ask you something. I've always had respect for you, but is your company handling the paper for China Minmetals? The next morning in the Globe and Mail, big headline, that guy's company was handling the paper for China Minmetals.
Are
we becoming just a country that's selling, that is ready to sell ourselves out for the highest bidder, come what may, and are we not ready to follow a bold and brave new direction that Stephen Harper's trying to set?
Well, I think we should be ready to follow a bold, brave new direction, but like all other Western countries, Canada is not unique in this. We are so afraid of losing out on the Chinese market that we're prepared to make dumb political decisions in order to get economic advantage. You know, the idea, and I've heard this expressed before, that we can make China less strategically threatening to us if we integrate them into the world economy is ridiculous. Japan was integrated to some extent into the Western economy prior to the Second World War. That didn't stop them. What stops countries from invading one another or being military threats to one another is the fact that they are pluralistic democracies with respect for human rights.
And democracies haven't gone to war against democracies.
Well, not very often. That's certainly true. And we reduce the chances that the next big strategic threat in the world beyond radical Islamism will be the Chinese if we pressure them to adopt more democratic rights and more human rights. And so I think this is not only in our political interest, I think it's also in our strategic interest.
Absolutely. And maybe to shift some of our business to a country like India, which at least is a functioning democracy rather than China, so the big corporations will make a few bucks less.
Well, I think they'll make plenty in India. I mean, India, since its economic liberalization, its moves away from Marxism, certainly has had an enormous boom, and I think there's great potential there for a lot of trade between Canada and India. And we already have the infrastructure here in the number of Indo-Canadians that there are who are ready to do business.
Lauren, I know your time is pressed tonight, but I want to ask you one final question. When I get mail on issues like this, Maritimes and Western Canada completely understand the direction this Prime Minister is trying to take this country. Central Canada, not so much. What is it? What's going on in this, you know, the Ottawa-Toronto-Montreal triangle?
Well, you know, and for 30 years now, maybe closer to 40 years, the whole idea of multiculturalism, soft power, accommodation, constructive engagement has been the hallmark of the Central Canadian policy establishment. I mean, I think beyond the policy establishment, a lot of people in Central Canada get it, but in that policy establishment, this is the way they've done things for 40 years, and it scares them to try something new.
Well, let's see if this thing can be shaken up. You know, our previous guest, Hillel Neuer from Geneva, executive director of UN Watch, quoted Churchill. Churchill said one other thing that is very apt today, and it's a lesson that Stephen Harper is trying to teach Canada. An appeaser is someone who feeds the crocodile, hoping he'll eat him last, but eat him he will. Lauren Gunther from Edmonton, thanks very much for joining us tonight.
Good, Beryl.
Take care. All right, we're going to leave the hurly-burly of the world scene and come back to Canada and our own little narrow narcissisms. Fascinating study came out last week. It was a joint effort of British and American privacy watchdogs. And it said that Canada ranked number 2 in protecting people's privacy. And to me, the most pithy and important comment on this was made by our next guest, who said, this report says far more about how badly privacy is protected than about how well Canada is doing. Canada's private sector privacy legislation is woefully outdated. Literally 2 decades after a report was issued for all sorts of reform, nothing has happened. Michael Geist, an expert in privacy law and the Canada Research Chair of Internet and E-Commerce Law at the University of Ottawa, welcome and thanks for joining us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
This problem is not going away. And just this week, again, the Privacy Commissioner of Canada went after Equifax for information getting leaked out all over the place. And Equifax is going to court to block her right to protect Canadians' privacy rights. And they'll probably win.
Well, we'll have to see the outcome of that case. But you're absolutely right. Equifax is challenging what's a core power that the Privacy Commissioner has. And frankly, she doesn't have very many. But this one in particular, which gives her audit powers, the ability on reasonable grounds to go in and audit organizations, is one of the few things she has that can keep organizations on their toes and force them to recognize that protecting privacy is an important part of their mandate. Yet Equifax now is challenging her ability to do that.
We are living in a country where, over the past several years, revenue departments at the federal and provincial levels have decided to end the status quo and are sharing our records with all departments in their governments and vertically with other levels of government. We've got an omnibus justice bill that includes internet telephony and email oversight, demanding that ISP providers turn over 8,000 files at a time without probable cause and simple requests of state security apparatus. We've got the government controlling every aspect of our social behavior, from little Johnny on his bike wearing a helmet to staying in school till you're 18 to where you can smoke and everything else, and sending inspectors around telling you they have a right to look in your drawers, by the way. This actually happened in my office building. The tobacco enforcement inspectors came in and said, we have a right to look in your drawers. And we asked him why, and he said, Article 33 of the Anti-Tobacco Law. We said, what about Section 7 of the Quebec Charter of Rights? With all this going on, how could anybody in their right mind conclude that Canada is protecting privacy rights?
Well, as I indicated in the comment that you led off with, I really do think that it says more about how badly countries around the world are protecting privacy rights than anything about how well we might be doing it. And in fact, there were, I think, some fundamental flaws with that particular study. It was one of those studies where they identified a whole series of criteria, treated them all equally, and then just added up the numbers. And so while they even came up with some questionable rankings for Canada on how it stands with enforcement, the truth is, I think it gives a bit of a distorted view about how well we're doing.
Michael Geis, please stay with us. We've got to take a short break. We'll be right back with you. And we're talking about privacy rights in Canada with Michael Geis, Canada Research Chair of Internet and E-Commerce Law at the University of Ottawa. Michael, this government, the current government, I have a great deal of admiration for the direction that the Prime Minister takes us in certain foreign policy initiatives and certain other initiatives. But I'm really disappointed that here is a small-C conservative, and one of the underpinnings of his thinking was to get the state out of our underwear and stop controlling our lives. And yet it seems the justice agenda, where privacy rights should be protected, they've just taken it from the old liberal omnibus bill, tacked on some other things that, frankly, aren't very palatable. And hasn't addressed the issue of privacy, not only privacy rights, but the consequence of the individual over the collective. Has that disappointed you?
Well, I think there were some that were hoping for a change. I have to admit that when the new government came in, this wasn't, articulated as a priority. So I don't know that it's a particularly big
No, it wasn't one of the 5 points, but it was a constant theme through the campaign and almost across the country of getting government out of our lives, protecting the individual.
Right. Well, I don't think that they've done very well on that score. You're right that the expectation is, from a justice perspective, we're going to see new surveillance legislation. There is absolutely no indication that the government's prepared to take a closer look at public sector privacy legislation. And a planned review of the private sector law, which is also in need of some reform, is going to occur over the next few weeks, but there's nobody that thinks it's going to amount to anything more than just some pro forma hearings without any significant change. So they haven't moved aggressively on this issue at all.
Assuming, sadly, that we can't get this country to understand that if we're sending the best of our young people abroad to fight a war on terror, we can't mirror at home what we're seeking to destroy. Assuming that public security issue, if the Prime Minister called you tomorrow and said, that aside, Professor Geis, what's your 1, 2, 3 wish list that we need to do to protect individual privacy rights in this country?
Well, we need to think about it both from a public sector and private sector. So from a public sector, the public sector legislation, which is now literally more than 20 years out of date, desperately needs wholesale reform. They almost need to pretty much tear it up and start from scratch, because it reflects a completely different world today than when it was enacted in the early 1980s. From a private sector perspective, we need basic things such as security breach disclosure legislation. In the United States, when an organization puts people's information out in the clear, or it hacked into, they've got to tell people about that because they might suffer from identity theft and the like, and it creates incentive to protect their information.
Hell, in this country, I remember the debate on the wiretap law in the late 70s under the former Justice Minister Otto Lange. In this country, they're supposed to tell people who are being wiretapped within 30 days that they're being wiretapped. They don't tell them until 6 months later, if that.
Yeah, no, there's issues on that side, but then there's issues even just on the private sector side. There's no obligations on organizations to disclose when security breaches have occurred, and they desperately need to have that. And then we have to recognize that if we're going to put some faith in the privacy commissioner to try to police some of these privacy issues, we've got to provide some kind of power. At the moment, all she's left with is a non-binding finding, such that most organizations just laugh at the notion that she can do much of anything at all.
Michael Geist, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
My pleasure.
We need to hear your voice more often.
Great, thanks.
Canada, the basis of our discussions tonight have been about where we are as a people, what our destiny as a people. Are we ready to take control of ourselves? Are we ready to define where we're going as a nation in foreign policy? Are we ready to redefine the importance of the individual over the state in domestic policy? Those are primordial issues. Destiny, William Jennings Bryan once said, is no matter of chance. It's a matter of choice. It's not a thing to be waited for. It's a thing to be achieved. It's time that we start achieving it. That's it for us tonight. Thanks to Nick Mays and Master Control. Coming up is Luciano Papilla, who'll be guest hosting the Financial Playbook, and he'll be talking about personal financial planning tonight.